for loose change under the couch. She sighed with relief. "Nothing yet," she told me. "But it's coming." "The first sign," she said, "would be little bumps on my chest, there, where my nipple was." This was when she decided to tell me about puberty, the part they left out in health class. It was all a big joke to us back then, but what my mom told me wasn't funny. It had to do with what would happen to me if I didn't listen and remember. The conversation was nothing like, "Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret," my only reference point for the talk. "They will come, the boys, like animals at the farm. So you have to be ready to resist them, because they will make your insides stir, and then things happen, and babies can come from it. And the next thing you know, you have to duct tape your floorboards to keep the roaches out." I hadn't remembered the duct tape, but suddenly I could see the old apartment in my mind. How one night my mom got up to pee and turned on the light and saw cockroaches everywhere. She let out this horrible cry and started beating them with the shoe from her closet, squashing them until their guts exploded. The next day, she bought a whole bag full of duct tape and went around the entire apartment, taping up the cracks where the walls met the floor, and all around the pipes under the sinks and around the heaters. We almost never saw a roach again. Just the silver tape reminding us that they were just on the other side, waiting for their chance to get back in. "Where do you think you end up, Charlie? With a baby at 16 and no education?" My mom was still so young and so beautiful. It was hard to believe her dreams were all dead. But she said they were, and that it was because of puberty and boys being animals at a farm and making your insides stir. And I believed her, because back then, I still believed everything she told me, making new rules at every turn. I knew how to look things up on the computer. Puberty was sometimes delayed in girls who are overly active. Girls who do gymnastics, for example. They didn't have enough fat for the hormones to work the right way, and they used too much energy doing their exercise. When I was 11 and my mom told me about what was coming any day now, and after I'd seen her give birth while the flies ate that baby's head on TV, it confused and terrified me, and I knew I had to stop it. It was too late for me to get into gymnastics. I read all about how the best gymnasts started young, taking lessons at 4 or 5 years old. But I could run. And for the next 3 years, that's what I did. I ran every day. I ran 1 mile, then 2 miles, then 5 miles. I found a training schedule for people running short marathons, not just one, but several throughout the year. I ran in the morning before school. I ran for hours after school. And when it was too cold to run or when the roads were covered with snow, I ran in place, in my room. They took me to a therapist because Dusty couldn't stand the pounding on the floors and my mom couldn't stand how strange this made me. One night, when Dusty had had enough of the pounding, they both came to my room, Dusty leading the way and my mom racing behind him as best she could with a baby in her arms. He saw me there, knees popping into my chest, one after the other, as fast and as high as I could make them go, panting for breath, and he told me to stop. I shook my head, no. And he told me again. And then he walked to me and picked me up off the floor, my legs flailing in the air. "Why, Charlie?" My mom was crying. "Why are you doing this?" I stopped air running so he would put me back down, a look of satisfaction on his face. And when they both left, I put on all the clothes that would fit on my body and went out to run in the snow. When I came back, the police were waiting at the house, and the doctors were waiting at the hospital, and they kept me there for 3 terrifying days. It wasn't easy to concentrate, but by the second morning, I had observed two things. First, no one showing emotion was allowed to leave. Tears, screaming, yelling, moping around, avoiding activities and people. Emotions did nothing but ensure they'd keep you another night. So I managed to smile. I watched TV in the common area. I made conversation with another kid who actually did seem kind of crazy. I did as I was told. The second was something I should have known before stepping foot in the place. I needed to apologize. Just like the teachers at school and Dusty at his house, anyone with power over me would bend if I said I was sorry. So when my mom came to see me and we sat with the doctor, I said I was sorry for running and hurting myself and making everyone worry. I said I didn't know why I had to do it, so the doctor fed me the answer. I was punishing them for having another baby. Classic sibling rivalry. I think that might be it, I told them. I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you. Over and over and over. On the third day, a new doctor came to see me. She didn't ask me about the running or my new brother. It was a complete shift from everything I'd been asked to do in the last few days. She started off by asking me if I had any questions for her, and I said yes. I asked her if it was true that exercise could keep my body from making babies. They let me out later that day, after a lot of tests, and on the way home, a word was passed back and forth between my mom and Dusty like a tennis ball on the court at their country club. It sounded like a question when Dusty said it. Autism? And like a revelation when my mother said it. Autism! No one said it to me. Not then. And not ever. I don't even know if they ever said it to anyone else. Because nothing changed in my life. Not a single thing. But as far as tricking biology goes, it couldn't last forever. When I turned 14, it happened. Right during the lunch rush at the Triple S. Janice gave me something from her purse and tried to console me in the bathroom. You can't stop your body from growing up, Charlie. And look at you. What a beautiful young woman you're becoming. When she said that word, woman, I burst into tears. Not just tears, but inconsolable sobs that made her scared for me. She brought me to the back room and got Nora from her office, and the two of them watched me cry until I was all cried out. I couldn't explain it to them. I wanted to, but I didn't have the words. I never said hothead out loud, and they wouldn't have understood it anyway. It had not been easy to trick biology, but I thought I had done it. I really thought I had won, and it had made me feel like I had skipped over the part of my life where my dreams could die. I told myself that it wasn't over, that I still had the power to control my destiny. I had the job at the Triple S, and my grades were so good that I was probably going to be first in line for the town's college scholarship, which pays for almost one semester of school and is only given to one student. If I could keep the animals from coming around, and if I keep my insides from stirring like my mom's did when my father circled around her, then I stood a chance of getting out of here, this place where I could wind up like that sad woman watching the flies eat her baby's head, where I was an unwanted snowflake, where I might become the last turkey and have to look at a man like Dusty for the rest of my life. All of those shitty things. I don't know why I thought this could only happen in Sawyer, but I did. And I became as obsessed with dodging God's trick and leaving this place as I had been with running. I hear Dusty and my mom still talking about me as if I couldn't hear their words or have any feelings about them. I am at the end of everything. My patience, my rope, the heat in my head. My mom reaches out and grabs my hands to stop my fingers from tapping, and I yank them away so quickly I nearly pull her to the ground. "Don't touch me!" I yell, because I can't keep it inside for one more second. I am a volcano, a hot, hot, hot volcano, and they have made me erupt. All of them. Dusty, my mom, Detective Pittsfield, and Slater, and even Dana Blakely, and most of all, Clay Cooper, who had to be such a bad man that in the end, someone had to kill him, and now I had to find a way out of the mess I was in, or I would never get to college. No one will want me. No one will want me. No one will want me, because I'm a girl like that. Because of my lopsided seesaw and hot head and tapping fingers. Charlie! Dusty tries to be scornful, but I don't care about him and his stupid words. I am saving my family at the Triple S, and I am going to college, and no one can stop me. Nora will have her truth. Janice will have her pride. Keller will have her love. And I will break the glass on this snow globe and fly away. Chapter 14. The day after I was brought into the police station, my mom let me take her car because it was raining and she didn't want to drive me. It was Sunday, and on Sundays, Dusty usually played golf after church, but because of the rain, he stayed home, which meant she could go back to her bed and not have to feed the boys until dinner time. Dusty was making them pancakes for lunch and then taking them to the toy store. I first see the stranger right outside Dusty's house. I see him but think nothing of it. He's just a man in a car drinking coffee. I only notice him because the house is on a dead end, so people come here to see us or a neighbor or to fix something or sell something, but not to park and drink coffee. I've never seen him or his car, a black SUV, before. So it enters my brain as a small thing. I don't even look a second time as I drive past. I see him again at the end of the lunch shift, but a lot of things happen before then. Nora comes in at 10:30, and she sees me when she pulls into the parking lot. I wave. She waves. I let her get to the door first because she needs time to open the lock and turn off the alarm. When I see the door swing open, I make a run for it, because I don't have an umbrella and the rain is coming down hard. She hangs up her coat. I hang up my coat. I put on an apron. She goes to her office, puts her purse on the floor. "They went through the place yesterday," she tells me, "top to bottom." A rush of adrenaline comes and goes. It goes because of the tone of her voice and the intonation and the inflection and all of those subtle things that I watch for when someone says something important like that. That's how I knew what she was about to say next before the words left her mouth. They didn't find a thing. She comes back out and we both lean against the sparkling metal tables. The place smells especially clean today. I'm waiting now. Waiting for her to tell me what she thinks about the fact that I was here the night Coop was killed. "That was the only camera," she says. "I feel bad that I didn't tell all of you, but Coop insisted. He wasn't trying to spy on the employees. You can hardly see in the service area from where the camera is positioned. But he didn't want you guys telling other people who might then know how to sneak around the camera. I don't know what he was afraid of. Maybe someone coming in and opening the register, taking the cash. He said he liked seeing everyone who came into his places. Coop did like his cash. He offered lower prices for customers who used cash, and he didn't accept any credit cards except MasterCard and Visa. Nora tried to tell him that no one used cash anymore. The kids didn't even have wallets. But Coop wouldn't budge. He came every day and emptied the register and went to Nora's office and counted it, and then either took it with him or put it in the safe. Every day, and for all of his businesses. I'm sorry if the camera got you into trouble. Nora places her hand on my shoulder, and I can see that she's sincere. She feels bad for me, but I feel bad for her. Are you in trouble with the police? I ask her, and she knows what I mean. My hiding under that counter and looking scared had turned the Triple S into a possible crime scene, made all of them would-be suspects. Not any problems that weren't already there. I had my differences with Coop. Janice had the fight with him yesterday. The police spoke to us, and Tracy and Helen. I imagine they paid a visit to Keller and Levi, too. But that was all. Just questions. I nod my head. She says then, I was at a meeting that night. A support group for people who lost loved ones in the military. They have them once a month, and this was our annual potluck dinner meeting, so it was on Friday. More of a festive evening. I brought a pie. Stayed until about 10. Janice, well, she was home with her kids in Shane, of course. I don't know about Keller. I'm hoping she'll be in today, but I haven't seen or heard from her. Nora rattles off the facts that will give them alibis for the night of Coop's murder. They haven't told us the time of his death, if they even know it exactly, or why they think he was moved. I consider their alibis and think that they aren't really that good. Nora didn't know if anyone at that meeting would remember when she left. And Janice only had Shane and her kids to back up her story. And who's to say that they wouldn't lie for her? No one was in the clear. Charlie, she says next, looking at me right in my eyes. Do you know what you're doing? I don't answer because I'm not sure what she's asking. Coop was the kind of man who attracts bad people. And bad people do bad things. And sometimes good people defend themselves against bad people. I don't know what happened that night, but I do know these things about Coop. The door opens then, and Janice rushes through, soaking wet from the rain. I have only a second before she will see me and come to me and hug me, and this moment with Nora will be over. So I look back at her and tell her with as much conviction as I can muster, I'm good. That's what people say my age now, even though I agree with my mom that it's annoying and stupid because it doesn't really answer any question. But it's very useful today. Before Nora can reply, there's Janice, right on cue. When she's done with the hugging, she rattles off a few things Nora hadn't told me. Like, oh, it was so crazy after you left, Charlie. And they closed us down, brought in about 6 people in those white suits with their shoes covered and hands covered. You know, forensics people, I ask. Yes, she says. And they went through everything, dusting for fingerprints, then taking all of our fingerprints, even poor Tracy, so they know which ones don't belong back here. But we told them, didn't we, Nora, about all the vendors who are in and out every week delivering food and the aprons and the paper goods and, oh my gosh, the bread. Every day the bread delivery and always a different guy. Well, not always, but you know, there have to be a dozen drivers the bakery uses. I remind myself that nothing was found. Nothing was found. Nothing was found. And the best part, Janice continues, was when they did that thing where they looked for blood with that special light. And do you know they didn't find one drop? Not one. And think of all the blood from the steak that drips on the floor from the slicing and the stalking and all of that. That's how well we clean this place. I know it's all terrible what's happening, but I felt very proud that our cleaning is the reason we're open today and all of us can work our hours. Yes, I think. A lot of blood is spilled here. And the reason there wasn't a trace, even with the luminol, is because of the special kind of bleach we use that removes even the invisible proteins of blood, which is what the luminol detects. A lot of people think regular bleach will do the job, but all it does is get rid of the stain. It leaves behind hemoglobin, which can still be detected by the police. Janice asked Nora to order bleach with active oxygen because she used it at home for Ollie when he was sick and swore that it got rid of more germs. It also gets rid of the hemoglobin in blood. Anyone who's ever watched any season of any CSI series knows that, and I've seen them all. Nora adds, "We also need to thank Regina. She could have closed us down, but she agreed to let me run the place until she figures things out." "That's nice of her," I say. Although she had no reason to close it down and lose money on selling sandwiches, especially with the IRS investigating. "We all need the work," Nora says, reading my mind. Janice sighs with relief. "Oh, amen." Lunch rolls around. Keller is a no-show. She calls in to tell Nora, and Nora tells us. I told her not to show her face anywhere until her bruises healed, so I'm relieved when she calls in sick again. There is a small line around 11:30, maybe 5 people waiting. It's then that I see the man for the second time. He sits in the same black SUV from the morning. The SUV is parked in our lot and pulled in backward so the man can watch us working inside the store through the windows. I swear I could feel his eyes on me as I take the orders. Still, I'm too busy for this thought or the image of him to worm through my brain and find the matching image from the car on my street that same morning. I'm pretty tired, and I have a lot of orders to take and sandwiches to make, so I dismiss it as a coincidence and file it away. I haven't slept much since Coop was murdered. When the lunch rush picks up, I fear that exhaustion will prevent me from concentrating, that I won't be able to clear the line, and it will weave out the door, and everyone will be upset and then not come back again, and the store will close, and Nora and Janice and Keller and me will all lose our jobs and the money we so desperately need. But it's the opposite. I'm on fire today, just like I was the morning after Coop was killed. 3 more customers enter. I yell to them, "What will you have?" And they look at one another, confused because there are customers before them in the line, and I'm already making their sandwiches, loading things on the French bread and inside the pitas. I yell it again, "What's your order?" And this time they answer, "Chicken salad, steak and cheese, Italian sub." Back and forth we continue. "What size?"
"Medium."
"Large?"
"Pita."
"What's it on?"
"What have you got?"
"Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions, ketchup, mustard, mayo, oil and vinegar, salt and pepper." I know this list like I know my own name. Within 20 minutes, the line is cleared. It's then that I remember about the man and the black SUV parked backward in the lot. I look outside and it's gone. He's gone. And I even wonder if it was ever there to begin with. I saw it before the mess was cleaned up. And no one sees things clearly with a mess to clean up. While I'm looking for this disappeared SUV, I see another car, a different car, pull in from the main road. It's not a police cruiser this time. It's a pickup truck. Ian's pickup truck. And there it is, right on cue. The stirring. I hear his voice telling me that I'm wrong when I break up with him. I hear him saying that love is everything. Love is everything. Love is everything. Ian is off duty today, and he wears jeans and a soft flannel shirt, which I want to press my face into and disappear, maybe forever. The feeling sweeps me away as I place 2 carefully sliced tomatoes on a medium ham and cheese for the woman before him in line. Janice sees Ian, then she sees me, and she takes the sandwich from my hands. "I'll finish this," she tells me. She rings the order and shoos me to the dining room. Ian and I walk to the very back of the store. I lead him to where the cameras can't see. "Hey," he says first. Hey, I say back, because that's another thing young people do now. I haven't heard from Ian since he drove me to the police station. He left me in a row of chairs waiting for the detectives because he said, at the time, it won't look good if we're together in here. I wonder now if the detectives kept their promise to Dana Blakely. I wonder if she was able to scare them enough not to tell anyone who didn't need to know about the security camera and what they saw on it. I wonder if her hair pulled into that tight bun and her navy suit and her black pumps and fancy corporate client with the DUI worked for or against her in the intimidation business. On the one hand, she looked important. That would be a plus. On the other hand, she was a woman, and that was always a minus. Sorry to say, but this is true. Women are always discounted. I make myself look into his eyes so I can find the answer, and I'm relieved when I do. How are you? He asks. It sucks they had to question you at the station. Was it because of Keller? I try to answer him, but it's too much now. It's all just too much. I cover my face with my hands, and Ian lets me fall against his chest and hold him with both arms, and I feel the soft flannel against my cheek as the tears fall. It's okay, he says, because that's the only thing you can say to someone who is suffering from a swell and crying into your shirt. He closes his arms around me, and I feel myself calm, because of the neurological response that's happening in my cerebellum, which is only 10% of my brain's mass, but holds over 50% of its neurons. I remind myself this. It's not Ian. It's just his touch. Anyone's touch could do this. It's not love. It's science. I move away, and he releases his arms, and nothing is said about it. Do they know anything else? I ask him, wiping my eyes and getting my stupid shit together like a person whose seesaw is just right, perfectly even. He shakes his head, but also shrugs his shoulders. I don't know. They're keeping it in a tight circle. The detective squad and two senior units. Ian is as rookies get, so he's not going to be put on this case, and I'm grateful for that. Do you know anything? He asks me. I wonder if I should be worried now. Like what? The others. Nora, Janice, Keller, and Levi. They say they have alibis, and there was no... I'm about to tell him about the bleach and how the police didn't find anything here, but then I stop myself, because why would I need to tell him unless I was worried? They're fine for now. I finish my thought with something else, and he doesn't notice. Will you tell me? If anything changes. I promise him I will, and then I ask him to do the same. Only if it won't get you in trouble. He says he wants to stay as far away from the case as he can, and I tell him I understand. Because that's the thing about people you care about. Rule number 8. If something hurts someone you love, it hurts you too. This is a heavy-weighted rule. It cannot be changed. It's in our nature. There are people here who wanted Clay Cooper dead. Nora, Janice, Keller, Levi. I care about all of them, and Ian cares about me. When he leaves, I think about this circle, because that's another thing people do. They don't tend to look outside of their snow globe. They see their world and forget it's not a world at all. It's a speck of dust so small God would need a microscope to see it. This is why I don't think about the black SUV or the man inside and the fact that I'd seen him twice in one day and in two different places. I take a long break before my second shift. But I don't use it to rest or eat or clean up. Instead, I check the inventory. I write it on paper because that's all we've been allowed to do, and I check every pan in the refrigeration units and then the cans and jugs and buckets of things stacked on the shelves that line the walls. I give the paper to Nora and expect her to do what she always does, which is to take her thumb drive from her bag and plug it in and put the numbers into the spreadsheets. But she doesn't do that today. She takes the paper and folds it into her bag. Of course, I think. That thumb drive is in a place where no one will find it. The real numbers for inventory, but also for sales and payments to vendors. All the things that she and Coop used to argue about. The arguments that put her on the list of suspects. I work the dinner shift. I clean the grill, the service area, the prep room. I sweep and mop and then collect all the trash from the bins and take it out to the dumpster. This is the third time I see the man. He sits now in the same black SUV that was parked on my street and outside the shop window. I watch him, and he watches me, and I walk a little faster back to the door, which I close and lock behind me, even though I'm almost ready to leave for the night. I am alone closing this door because Keller didn't show, and no one could come in to work her shift. It's always slow on Sunday nights, and I was happy to have the place to myself. I wait inside for another half an hour. I wait with all the lights out until finally I see the car, the black SUV, drive out of the parking lot. I grab my coat and phone and my mom's car keys. I turn on the alarm code and check one last time to make sure everything is off. I don't have store keys, so once I close that back door, the main lock will lock and there's no getting back in. I don't see the car as it drives back into the lot. And my mom's car is parked on the other side of the dumpster, so I don't see the car parked sideways behind it. I click open the doors. I open the driver's side, get in, put the keys in the ignition. What I don't do is lock the doors. And so the man also opens a door and also gets into my mom's car right behind me, where I can't see his face except in the rearview mirror. Then he says, simply, Chapter 15.
Don't turn around.
But...
I'm gonna place something on the console between your seat and the passenger seat. Wait until I'm done and then take it.
Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions, lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Okay. I have it.
Now you place your phone in the same spot. I'm gonna take it, but just until we're done talking.
Okay.
Now, I'm gonna shine the flashlight from your phone through the seats. You can use it to look at what I've given you.
Okay.
Can you see it?
It's a wallet.
It looks like a wallet. Open it, then tell me what you see.
Okay. It's some kind of ID card. It says Agent Maxwell Zellman, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Right. Do you know what that is?
The FBI.
Right. I'm an agent with the FBI. Agent Max Zellman. If you look in the rearview mirror, I'll move to where you can see me, but don't turn around.
But...
In case someone's watching you, they need to think you're alone. Look up now, in the mirror. I know this is scary. Anyone would be scared by a stranger getting into the back of their car, so it's okay to be afraid and nervous. But I want you to know that I'm here to help you, Charlie. You don't need to be scared about that, about why I'm here. I want to walk you through everything nice and slow. And I'm going to start by telling you some things, and then asking you some things. And I need you to listen carefully and answer truthfully, okay?
Okay.
I'm part of a unit that investigates white-collar crime. We work out of Pittsburgh. We've been investigating an operation there in connection with our narcotics team. The people in this operation deal drugs and launder their money through small businesses throughout the state. Do you know what money laundering is?
Yes, of course. In season 5 of Breaking Bad, Walter White launders his drug money through the A1A car wash.
That's right, Charlie. I love that show. Walt mixed the illegal money from the drug business with the legal money from the A1A car wash so no one could tell the difference. And it all looked like car wash money, right? Now, this operation in Pittsburgh is run by a man. I can't tell you his name, so I'll refer to him as Barry. But the name's not important anyway. What's important is that Barry's very dangerous. Do you understand?
Yes, but
you're a good girl, Charlie. I know a lot of things about you and your family and everyone at the Triple S because we've been investigating this place for months.
You've been watching us?
Yes. You don't need to be scared. I can see you tapping your fingers together. That's what you do, isn't it, when you get nervous?
Lots of people do that. What else do you think you know about me?
Well, I know that you have the highest GPA in your class. It's a 4.4 because you get extra points for all of your AP classes, isn't that right? And I know that you got a very high score on your SAT, and that you've been accepted to MIT. But you have to find a way to pay for it because your stepfather, Dustin Madison, claims you on his taxes. You've saved some money, but you also need that scholarship that the town awards each year to make it through your first year. See? That's a lot of information I have that comes from investigating.
Everyone knows about those things. They're not secrets, and they don't prove that you've got some special way of finding things out about me or anyone else.
Well, how about this? I know that the town has voted on the scholarship recipient, and they plan to announce it next week. I also know who they voted for. Stop, Charlie. Don't turn around. I know it's hard.
Just tell me then.
I'll tell you when we're finished. First, I need you to do what I asked before. Listen closely, and then answer when I ask you questions. Are you ready?
Yes, just do it already. This is really annoying and I want to go home.
Okay, don't worry. I'll be as quick as I can. First, we believe that Barry has been laundering money through Clay Cooper's businesses here in Sawyer. He has the Triple S, the diner, the tobacco store, and some apartment buildings. Second, we believe he does this at the Triple S by creating false reports that inflate both his sales and his inventory costs. That way he can account for the money Barry gives him, but also deduct the money when he gives it back so he avoids paying taxes. The money going out isn't really going to vendors for inventory. It's just going into Barry's pocket, in cash. Coop then gets to keep some of that cash as a fee for his services. Now, imagine he's doing this at all of his businesses. He can clean a lot of Barry's money without raising any red flags with the IRS. Do you understand?
Yes. It's not very complicated.
Have you noticed a lot of cash transactions at the store?
Yes. But isn't that normal? Lots of people pay for food in cash.
Is there anything else you've noticed?
I don't know. I just make sandwiches.
You seem nervous, Charlie. Are you sure you don't know a bit more about the business?
I'm good.
Well, we know you helped the manager, Nora Ullman, keep the records. We know she puts them on some kind of thumb drive and takes them home at night. And we know that some of the vendors Clay Cooper pays for the fake inventory have addresses that don't match any real locations for any real companies. Now, let's talk about Friday night. You see, even though Clay Cooper's body was found on the street outside his house, we know that you were here that night, and that you heard something and maybe saw something that you shouldn't have. We also know that the safe in the office was empty when the police broke it open and that Clay Cooper's cell phone was not found on his body. Very strange, don't you think?
I wouldn't know what's strange or not strange about a crime scene.
Really? Even after watching 5 seasons of Breaking Bad? I bet you watch a lot of shows. That's what the kids do these days, right? Binge Netflix and all that?
Whatever, so I watch TV. That doesn't mean I know what might be weird in a real case.
Okay, let's go back. When a person deals in cash like that, cash they're trying to hide, it either goes through secret bank accounts or it's physically transferred from one person to the other person. Now, I'm betting Clay Cooper isn't a big fan of banks, right? Oh, that's okay. I know you're aware of his idiosyncrasies. But see, that means there was probably cash in that safe, and information on that cell phone about upcoming drops of larger amounts of cash. Cash that Barry wants, and will do some pretty scary things to get. Because it's his money, really.
How do you know he didn't kill Coop and take it himself, if you know everything?
Well, that is certainly a possibility. And if that did happen, if he does have his money because he or one of his men was there that night and killed Mr. Cooper, what other reason would he have to be in town? Come on, Charlie. You know the answer. We know Barry is here in Sawyer. So he either wants his money because someone killed Clay Cooper and took it, or what?
He thinks I can identify him as the killer.
Right. In which case, he'll be watching you very closely, won't he? And if he thinks you know something that could hurt him, or if he thinks you have the cash in Clay Cooper's cell phone, either way, you're in great danger.
But that doesn't make any sense. If Barry shows his face in Sawyer where he doesn't belong, won't that expose him to people like you? Won't that draw attention to the fact that he was using businesses here to launder his money? Wouldn't that be pretty stupid for a smart criminal who runs a crime ring?
All good questions, Charlie. But just because he's in Sawyer doesn't mean he's visible. We think he's hiding out somewhere and that he has a small team of people with him. People who are less visible. We think we know who some of his associates are, but not all of them. He could even have local people here in town who work for him and live right under everyone's noses. But we do know for sure that he's not in Pittsburgh, and this is the most likely place for him to be, given everything that's happened. And your friends, Charlie. Think about them. If Barry didn't kill Clay Cooper, and if he thinks you know who did but aren't telling the police, then he's going to assume it's someone you care about, don't you think? And that if you don't have the money and the cell phone, then maybe one of them does? The one who killed Clay Cooper? The one you're protecting?
That's all just so shitty.
Listen to me now. It's all gonna be okay. We can protect you, Charlie. If you help us catch him and make an arrest, he'll go to jail and you'll be safe. You can go to college, just like you planned. Leave Sawyer forever and never look back. I'm gonna place my card on the console now, and your phone. Think it over and call me anytime, day or night. That's a direct line. There may also be some reward money for you, which you're gonna need. Because of the vote by the town council? Well, it didn't go your way, Charlie. You're not getting that money.
That's a lie. That money always goes to the student with the highest GPA. You're a liar.
I'm afraid it's true. It went to a kid named Doug who plays football and got into Alabama.
Liar! He barely has a 3-point average. It's not even close.
Why don't you ask your stepfather? He's on the council, right? And the vote was unanimous. Goodbye for now, Charlie. We'll do our best to keep you safe. And please, be smart about this. Don't tell anyone we spoke. Don't tell anyone we're investigating Clay Cooper's murder. Our best chance of getting Barry off the street is to catch him off guard. And that's also your best chance of keeping yourself and your friends safe.
Chapter 16. My hands shake as I drive. They shake so hard I can barely hold the wheel. I think through what Agent Zellman told me. Some criminal named Barry either wants me dead because I saw his men kill Coop, or he thinks I stole his money and he wants it back. Maybe he's right. Maybe Nora's right. Maybe there is more danger here than I thought. Where men like Coop own everything in sight, and worse men like Barry from Pittsburgh own men like Coop. I have been fighting so hard to get out of this place that I wasn't paying attention to what was actually here, all around me. Coop taking money from Barry, cleaning it with crooked books, forcing Nora to turn a blind eye even though her signature is on everything. Barry making that dirty money in dirty ways. Suddenly the things I know feel too big to wrap my head around. Suddenly they feel too heavy to carry alone. My hands turn the wheel to the right, the way that leads to Dusty's house. This is my instinct, even though I know there's no one there who can help me. I take my hands from the wheel. I close my eyes. I don't know what I should do. But I know what I have to do. I've put people in danger, people I love. Taking the wheel again, I turn to the left, the way that leads into town, and then to the other side where we used to live in our shitty apartment, where Janice and Shane live and where Keller lives. It's quiet on the street. Nothing is open on Sunday night. I drive past the grocery and the gas station on the left, then a small strip of shops on the right. Among them is Coop's tobacco store and then his diner. I think about how those places also dealt with cash and how Coop made his rounds every day, picking up the register receipts, picking up the cash, bringing it somewhere. I step on the gas, leaving the town in my rearview mirror. I drive past a small condo 2 miles out. It's in a cluster of condos that sit close together. They are cared for, but overcrowded. Old cars in their driveways, garages doubling for patios, some of them with artificial turf and lawn chairs, kids' bikes piled up on the lawns. The third one on the left is where Janice and Shane live, and I drive past it slowly now, looking for lights in rooms and people moving around, looking for strange men in black SUVs watching from the street, looking for any sign of anything not right. It's quiet. A man sits on his front steps smoking a cigar, and he waves at me, and I wave back. I slow to a stop long enough to see a body move across a room through the draperies, and then a second body. They move at a normal pace. A light turns off in the room. A light turns on upstairs. Janice and Shane heading up to bed. The kids probably all asleep by now. What did I think I would find? What has this man put inside my head? The night of Coop's murder, something entered my body, my blood. A chemical, a drug. I've been too wired to sleep. My head hot, then cold, hot, then cold. It's been 2 days, and there's been a shift. Maybe from the exhaustion. Maybe from Agent Zellman and the fear he's injected into me. Maybe from the shock and then anger when he told me about Dusty voting against me. I have no idea what's happening inside myself. I make the turns and drive until I get to Keller's street. Now I'm even more careful because Keller is my best friend, and if Barry wants to hurt me and if he's been taking these 2 days to find things out about me, then he will know this. I turn off the headlights. I pull to the curb where I could see down the street to Keller's house. One light is on upstairs, in the back. It's either the bathroom or Dot's bedroom. It seems quiet. The doors are all closed. The car is in the driveway. I take my phone and send 2 messages. First, to Nora. She lives 10 miles from town in an apartment, so I won't be able to see anything just by driving by. I text her with something simple. We need to order lettuce. Thanks. See you tomorrow. I send a second text, this one to my mom. I say that I'm at Keller's house and I will have the car back before she wakes up tomorrow. I wait for the replies, which come quickly. Thanks for letting me know, Charlie. That was Nora, and I think she must be okay. And you better be. That was my mom acting annoyed, which means she's okay. Janice, Nora, my mom, and now to Keller. I leave the car and walk down the street. I lace the keys between my fingers and close my palm around them. I am paranoid, made delusional. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm focused. Maybe I'm clever. Every scary movie I've ever seen emerges. Memories of scenes with a terrified woman on a dark street, people after her, danger lurking. Bad guys everywhere, all around. Jason and Freddy and Ted Bundy. These stupid keys won't stop them with their chainsaws and knives, and they won't stop Barry, who would surely bring a gun. I walk behind her neighbor's house, then cut across the lawn to Keller's yard and back door. I take the spare key from the top of a small lantern that hangs on a shingle, and I let myself in. I hear them the moment I step inside. One voice yelling, one voice pleading. I walk through the kitchen to the foot of the stairs and listen again. They're in the bathroom. I hear water splashing. Their voices are strained. I bound the steps two at a time until I reach the top, then run down the hall. The door is open, but neither of them sees me. Dot is in the water, naked, struggling. Keller is trying to keep her from climbing out. It's not difficult because Dot is frail and weak, but she won't stop fighting. I step inside. "Let me help you," I say. And if Keller is surprised at the sight of me, she's too upset to show it. Dot sees me as well and hisses.
"Another whore just like you. You're all a bunch of whores."
She pushes Keller's hands away.
"Don't touch me, you filthy whore."
Keller lets go, and Dot tries to pull herself out of the water using the sides of the tub, but she's too feeble to even lift her body. She lays back down and begins to cry. The cry becomes a sob and then a wail. A woman into a small child. Keller kneels at her side. Her hair is drawn into a ponytail, and I can see the bruise on the back of her neck. She wears old sweatpants and a t-shirt, and I think to myself that these are the same clothes I helped her change into Friday night. She draws a breath, takes a washcloth that floats on top of the soapy water. "Dottie," she says in a quiet voice. "It's me. It's Keller. And this is Charlie, remember? I'm your granddaughter, and this is my friend." She gently washes the tears from Dot's face and leans in close until the woman can lock eyes with her. Dot is beginning to calm down, the child soothed.
"Keller, is that you, sweetheart?"
Now comes the heavy sigh that always follows one of these episodes. "Yes, Dottie, it's Keller, and Charlie is here, see?" Dot looks at me and her face grows soft and loving.
"Oh, Charlie, you came to see me?"
I nod. "Yes, Dottie, I came to see you." Keller turns her head around to look at me. She places her hand on my wrist and gives it a squeeze. Her face shocks me. The bruises have grown darker. Black mascara is smeared around her eyes, worn down from crying and rubbing. She hasn't showered. She hasn't changed her clothes. She hasn't even washed her face. I don't say anything about any of it because I fear she might fall apart more than she already has. She's let Coop touch her and threaten her and belittle her every single day for years. She's let her grandmother call her a whore while she changes her diapers and washes her sagging skin clean. Keller is on a tightrope. She has to keep her eyes where they are, only a few inches ahead of her feet, so her balance will remain perfectly calibrated. I am not going to be the one to make her look away and fall. I get a towel ready, and together Keller and I help Dot out of the water. Her body is worse than I've ever seen it. Skin hanging from bone like it's on a hanger in a closet. Blue veins protrude and run from her feet to her chest, up her legs and across her arms. She is wasting away. I wrap the towel around her and we walk her to her bedroom. Keller finds a nightgown and we get her dressed.
"Oh, you lovely girls. Good girls. That's what you are. Good girls, good girls, good girls."
She says this over and over as though trying to stick it in her mind so she won't forget. We put her into bed, on her back, and propped up on pillows. Keller tucks the blankets tightly under the mattress so she can't get out easily, if at all. She lifts the metal rails that flank the sides so she won't roll off. Then she kisses her on the cheek.
Good girls. Good girls.
The words echo as we turn out the light and close the door. Keller locks it from the outside. Then she falls into my arms and cries. When she's done, we sit on her roof outside her bedroom window. It's slanted, but not too steep, and faces the side where we can see over some of the rooftops of her neighbors. The sky is dark, and there's a chill in the air. We huddle under one blanket and lean back against the side of the house. It's bad, right? Keller asks me. She's not eating anymore. I thought it was enough, but you saw her, right? She needs to be in a facility, and not the state one where she tried to kill herself because those idiots gave her the wrong pills. She needs people who know what they're doing. She stops herself long enough to light a cigarette. She takes a drag, then hands it to me. The nicotine is like magic on my nerves. A wave rushes through me, and I close my eyes and give into it. Intoxication is every bit as intoxicating as they warned us in health class. We don't speak. We just smoke. We smoke until the cigarette is down to the butt. Keller smashes it out on the roof, then flicks it onto the ground. He's gone. For good. She says then. Who? I ask. Levi. He says he doesn't want to be with me. Not after the fight we had Friday, after I lied to him. And now Coop is dead. She shakes her head, then hangs it in the palms of her hands. I don't know what to say. My heart breaks right beside hers. I find words, but they sound hollow. I think about rule number 5. Once you betray a friend, you lose them forever. He'll be back. I know he will. He loves you. And he has to understand. Doesn't he see what's going on here? And all the time I watched Keller put up with Coop, I never said one word to her. I never said things like, how can you let him look at you that way? Or how can you let him say those things to you? I can easily calculate the money she must need to pay for this house and the car and Dot's medicine. I've never had to do anything but save money for college because I'm lucky. I'm the lucky one who has a chance of getting out of here. I was not going to judge Keller, but I'm not Levi. I'm not her jealous boyfriend. She shakes her head. I don't think so, Charlie. You don't know him. He has this pride that is just so big. There's no room in it for this, for me being anything but his girl. But you are his girl. You've never been anyone else's. I've known you almost all our lives.